Hey, because I'm Todd, I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for asking me to speak. Annie, so thank you. And it's always a good time to come back up here. I live in Sarasota now. I'm Todd, I'm an alcoholic. Sorry, didn't say that yet. So I got sober on August 9th, 1998, and I got a sponsor, and I sponsored some guys, and I'm always willing to sponsor some more. And I just recently moved from D.C. to Sarasota, about an hour away, and it always just blows me away to come back up here. One, because it's like a big city, Tampa, compared to Sarasota, and you know, there's buildings and young people and all that. And but also, I mean, just coming here is this group. Like I got to be a part of this group a long time ago, and just seeing it what it is now is really touching. But I got sober when I was 19. And I'm 31 now, and if you're new, I promise I would not have spent all my 20s in AA if it wasn't a good time, you know what I mean? I would not have done that if, because by the time I was 25, I was pretty much out of trouble, you know what I mean? I mean, I wasn't in big trouble before that, but, you know, like finished college, you know, I thought I was like, wow, we're a grown-up now, look at me. And so why keep going to AA after that, you know what I mean? And I got a job and kind of got... My relationship with my parents got mended, and I kind of walked around D.C. in a suit and looked like everyone else, but I still went to AA meetings every night, you know, so why would I do that, you know? I think in our book, in Dr. Bob's story, in the end, he points it out better than I ever could, but the first thing he says, why does he keep doing this? It's a sense of duty, you know what I mean? And it really, it feels like that. It's like I'm worth something here, worth something more than anywhere else I could ever go. You know, and I don't know. So I'm really grateful to be here. I'm always grateful to do stuff like this. But like I said, I got sober when I was 19. So when I was born, when I was in the womb, we'll start there, and then we'll go quick. So don't be worried. But we're my dad worked. He's from Kansas, and he talks just like Hank Hill from King of the Hill, and. He, since college, he got a degree, and he grew up on a farm, and he got a degree in animal husbandry, which is, you know, for animals. And then he went back to work on the farm. He started working for Dow Chemical. So his whole entire life, he's worked for Dow Chemical, pushing pesticides, right? And my mom is like this sweet Southern lady. And so when I was in the womb, my dad didn't know. She was, like, downstairs gardening, and he's upstairs trying to kill wasps or whatever, and he just hoses her down with all these pesticides, right? So so she got really sick, and they're like, what's going to happen to Todd? You know what I mean? And I came out, and I didn't have any superpowers or anything, but they always kind of thought, apparently, that I was a little retarded. And I walked funny when I was growing up. I had my feet pointed in, and not for physical reasons. Like, I didn't have a club foot. I just walked that way. You know what I mean? And I looked around like this a lot when I talked to people, and I was an awkward guy. I had a lot of tics and a lot of nervous stuff going on, and I just was a weirdo, you know. So when I was about like 10 or something, I was a latchkey kid. My mom worked, and my dad worked, so I would just go home after school and watch Ninja Turtles and progress through the Disney cartoons of the day. And one day I went through my mom's files and I saw this file and it said Todd on it. It's like, it's about me, so I opened it up and it said, you know, Mrs. Campbell, we're sorry to inform you that your son Todd has been rejected from the Scottish Baptist School for retarded children. And I thought, there it is. That's why I'm so weird and I feel so different from everybody else, because I'm special like that. And I asked my mom when she got home. She said, you know, we just thought you were, but you know, you're all right. And I was like, okay, all right. So I was just a weird kid. You know what I mean? I played a lot of. Before the internet, we had bulletin board systems, right? So, like, I was a nerd, and I would call another nerd from my computer, but we'd do it over the phone line on, like, a 2400 baud modem, and we would just, we didn't have, like, G-chat, you know what I mean? We would just chat, though, like, through the computer, just nerd each other up, basically. And, you know, like, we didn't have email, but, like, you might send me electronically, like, a picture of, like, Cindy Crawford in a bikini, and it would take, like, one pixel, like one line. It'd take like an hour, and I just get so excited about it. And that's what I was into. And my brother, I got a big brother. His name's Chad, and he's 3.5 years older than me. He's captain of the football team, and they went to state championships when he was a senior and plays guitar, good looking dude, you know, I mean, just dated cheerleaders, and I was just nothing like this guy, you know what I mean? And when I was about 14-ish, he had all his football player buddies over, and we were playing pool. I was playing video games in the basement listening to Nine Inch Nails, and then all these big dudes come in, you know what I mean? And they all, you know, they smell bad, and they've been at football practice all day, and I'm like tiny, and I got big zits, and big glasses and big braces, and they're ginormous and cool, and talking about, you know, so-and-so, this chick and that, and I'm like, you know, I'm nervous. And we start playing pool, and I grew up with a pool table, so I was pretty good at pool for, like, a 14-year-old, you know what I mean? It's just how it is when you grow up with a pool table. But I couldn't get a shot right, you know what I mean? I was just shaky, and one of them gave me a beer, and my brother was like, dude, don't give my brother a beer, you know what I mean? Because my brother's a good guy, just all around. But they gave me a beer anyway, and I drank it, and taste was regardless. It didn't matter. When it hit my stomach, I was suddenly like, I wasn't cool, but I was the coolest little brother of a cool guy that there could be. You know what I mean? And I knew that. And I knew, like, I just something like I found where I fit. It was like I got humility, you know what I mean, right away. It was like I'm Chad's little brother, and they can't really kick me out. And if they had to be stuck hanging with any little brother, I'm probably the best that they could do. You know what I mean? Because I'm all right, you know? And I went upstairs, and I made some nachos, and I brought them down, and they were a hit, you know? And everyone, like, I was like, yeah, you know? And that was the start. And I didn't go out and take the rest of the case of beer or steal a car and go to downtown D.C. and get some crack or anything that night. I mean, it took a while to progress. The next two years was like a slow progression, and then the next two after that till I was 19 was just almost like exponentially, like compounding on itself, fast progression of just destroying my own life, you know? And I went to this great hearing Miriam speak, because we went to high school together, and we were in the Chronic Dreamer Society. I started a poetry club when I was smoking a lot of weed, and we were in the poetry club. There was like four or five of us, you know what I mean? So it's kind of neat. Barely any of us from Langley got sober, so it's kind of cool. But I really enjoyed your talk a lot. It was really clear message. And but what I was gonna say is I went to like a pretty decent public high school. Like the valedictorian had a 4.7. You know what I mean? Like all A's doesn't cut it. You know what I mean? I felt like, why try, you know? And I did good enough to get into a school in New Orleans, and I got there, and I just got as wasted as possible for a year. Just to kind of fast forward through that, I went there, like, drinking occasionally, and, like, it says in our big book, after the first four chapters, they're all like, this is an alcoholic. No, this is an alcoholic. This is what a doctor says an alcoholic is. Look at Jim. He's an alcoholic. Then finally, it kind of sums it up in We Agnostics, and it says, if when you honestly want to, you can't stop or you can't quit entirely, you're probably alcoholic. So that's like an or. Like, if you qualify for either of those, guess what? You're drunk, you know? But if you're I kind of fit in both right away. If I would have looked at my life right when I got to Tulane, when I honestly wanted to quit entirely, and I tried a few times to be good before that, even in high school, I couldn't quit. I couldn't quit getting wasted. There was a period of time where I hung out with all Mormon kids, and I went to country western shows, and I quit going to the punk rock shows and the raves, and just tried to be good, because these Mormons are, like, good, you know what I mean? And they're so good, they don't swear. You know, they don't eat sugar on Sunday. That's how good they are. You know what I mean? And I'm going to be good like them. But it didn't, you know, I was baffled when I got wasted. And it was almost like the weed smoked me. You know what I mean? It was almost like that. It was like, how the fuck did this happen? You know what I mean? Because I was sober, telling everyone I was sober and just how good I'm doing. You know what I mean? And then a friend of mine who also quit with me found some, called me, and I had no defense against it. Just no. I was like, yeah, let's do it. Why not? And I got caught immediately. And that was the last time I ever cried, was that night when I was like 16 and I just got caught. Couldn't believe it. I was baffled that I got wasted when I didn't want to. So anyway, in New Orleans, I just went full goose bonkers, you know what I mean? Just went, did everything he put in front of me, which was pretty much everything I've heard of at the time. If I never did peyote because they didn't have it there that I know of, and but other than that, I think I did it all, you know, that existed at the time. And I just, you know, kind of failed at everything. Fried my brain pretty good. And in the end of it, I failed out of school, you know, obviously. All the kids that I knew that liked to get wasted and go to school were cut out of my life because I didn't go to school. And then all the kids I knew that, you know, liked to get wasted but quit doing school but now they're getting a job, you know, they were not hanging out with me anymore either. So I was just hanging out with people who liked to get wasted. And it was bad, man. It was like I moved in with this chick because her boyfriend was a drug dealer. And I thought, well, I'll try and be a coke dealer. You know what I mean? Maybe I could try that. And I thought maybe I could sell coke and heroin because I don't enjoy coke and heroin as much as I like drinking. But I did it all anyway, you know. And she took in a cat off the street. And so it was me and the cat and her. And I slept in her closet every day. Because I didn't have a bed. I had a room that I technically was renting, but I hadn't paid rent yet. I owed it, and I didn't have any furniture in it. And her closet was carpeted, so I stayed in the closet. Made sense. And we had the house that people went to after the raves were over in New Orleans. And sometimes I would get out of the house and ride the trolley down to the French Quarter and bring my. So the devil sticks are it's like a toy, about as important as a yo-yo. But I'm the best in the world at the devil sticks. I'm just going to put that out there. It's about as important as being really good at yo-yoing. But I would go down to the French Quarter with my devil sticks, and I would think, I'm going to get discovered today, man. This is going to happen. You know what I mean? And I would get a little crowd around me, and people would be like, God damn, that's kind of cool. Let's go, honey. You know what I mean? And just kind of walk away. And every now and then, someone would throw me a nickel, but I never really made much. The other street performers had permits to street perform, and they had territory, and they had rights to be there, and they could talk. I was so cooked on everything, I could say, hey, I'm Todd, you know what I mean? But I couldn't guarantee that I was going to get a full sentence out ahead of time, because I knew that, you know, from time to time, I would just lose the ability to speak, and everything would turn and melt into puddles again, and I was just that cooked on drugs, you know? So I kind of frightened people, I think, and the other street performers told me to go away, and a mime yelled at me, and he said he was going to shoot me if I came back to Café de Mon, because I would get a crowd around me pretty good, and then I'd freak them out, and they would leave, and then he couldn't make any money. I mean, he was pissed, so I failed at that, failed at school, and there's a gas station up the street that was hiring, and that was the next thing I was going to fail at, you know? We didn't have a washer and dryer in the place, so I smelled bad. I had one towel that was not usable anymore because it was just tough, you know what I mean? About then, this guy named James drove by. James is the first guy that ever sold me Dilaudid and showed me how to put a needle in my arm. He's kind of my idol in a sick way, you know? And he's an older dude who'd been selling drugs in New Orleans for a while. And he drove by and stopped by our house to say goodbye because he's going to go to rehab, you know? And I was like, man, that's cool. James is getting help. And this car wouldn't start in our driveway. It just broke down right there. So we moved in. And I was like, all right. So now it's me, it's James, and the cat, and the girl, Amber. It was bad, man. It was just bad. I would wake up around 3 in the afternoon, and I would try to get out there and sell that dope, and I just couldn't muster up the strength. You know what I mean? And I would just do some of it. And the dishes were piling up, and... You know, and the cat's just being crazy, and it had mites in its ears, and it was just bad news. And I love cats. I had a cat when I was growing up, and I was like, man, you know what I mean? It just looking at it made me sad. And I was scared. I was scared of Amber, the girl, because I knew I wasn't going to be able to pay her rent. And me and James would just kind of steal each other's drugs, but we were best friends. You know what I mean? We just kind of. Sat around and sweat a lot in New Orleans in the summer and got wasted as possible, you know what I mean? Time went by, and we were bagging and cutting all the heroin up on the ground on this mirror because we didn't have any furniture. We had a milk crate with a little TV on a 13-incher, and that was it, really. You know what I mean? An inflatable couch and a mirror on the floor. So we'd cut and bag up the stuff, and the cat would, like, play with its reflection, you know what I mean? And then it would lick its paws, and then the cat started nodding out and started puking, and I was like, you know, like, fuck. And meanwhile, I'm asking James every day, like, how many days, am I going to get hooked, you know what I mean? Like, I really don't want to get dope sick. And I'm he's dope sick every day if he doesn't get high, and I'm not at that level yet, because I'm just doing heroin 2 days and then none, and then 2 days and then none, because lots of junkies told me that's how you don't get hooked on opiates. And I was like, they would know, right? And so the cat is definitely hooked, you know what I mean? And I'm just, like, waking up at 3 in the afternoon now, after, like, a few days of being up, and I look around, and there's cat shit everywhere, because cats shit everywhere when they're on heroin. And you know, I'd look, I'd just kind of open one eye and just be like, is there any cat shit on me? You know what I mean? And, like, maybe. You know, and I'd get up, and I'd, like, start walking, and there's, like, okay, just walk through the minefield of cat crap, you know? And I think, what, man, you got to clean this shit up, you know? And when are you going to do this? And, you know, why won't they clean it? They're not going to clean it. You got to clean it. And your head just starts going. And then I would think about my mom, you know, and how she's going to call. My mom paid the phone bill at the house so she could call and yell at me every day. And it would come in around 5 in the afternoon. My mom's, like, a pretty sweet Southern lady. Always has had, like, a good. She's actually been Teacher of the Year twice. And like, they normally don't do that, you know what I mean? But she won it twice in a row because she's pretty badass, you know. I just broke her, you know what I mean? Just with my crazy shit constantly. And my dad wouldn't even call anymore. And so I knew my mom was gonna call and yell at me. And I would think about, like, how just gross I was, you know what I mean? A bad, bad acne from not showering, and then all the LSD and picking at my face. I looked like a monster, and I was, you know, just green skin, not eating much. And I'm in New Orleans, which is, like, the best food in the world, and I'm not eating any of it because I don't have any care about anything but getting wasted. And I can't get a job. And I would think about the high school I went to and how, like, you know, I mean, I had a couple wins before I went off to New Orleans. You know, I was, like, pretty good at track and field, and, you know, I started that poetry group. That was a hit, you know, and a couple things. But I was just like, what happened to you, man? You know, like, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to live past, like, 25, you know what I mean, just going at this rate. And then I would find booze in the house, and it was often that there was some laying around because people would come to our house and party. And I would start to put it down, and it would go down, and it would hit my stomach. And I would think, like, it's going to, you know what? You know what we're going to do today, Todd? We are going to do some laundry. We're going to round up, so we're going to sell a little bit of that dope because we're going to be a man. We're going to get out there and work and sell some dope, and we're going to get some money, and we're going to get to the laundromat, and we're going to do some laundry, and we're going to smell good. You know what I mean? And I would think, like, you're going to go return Starship Troopers at the video store. You've had it for 2 months, and we need another thing to watch. And I would think about that, and, like, it's going to be all right, man. We're going to call Mom before she calls you, and maybe she won't yell as much, you know? And I would think, you know what, first, I'm going to name that cat. I'm going to do that right now. That's what I'm going to come up with a name. I'm going to pen, piece of paper, start writing stuff down, and we're going to come up with something and just nail it. You know, because I just couldn't commit to a name before that. But I knew if I didn't keep drinking, that feeling would go away, you know what I mean? And that feeling of hope and that we're going to, the gusto would just leave. And I had to keep drinking. And our book says it's like a phenomenon of craving, you know what I mean? And that's the way I remember it, was like, no, I need the hope, you know what I mean? I need this feeling, I need it to keep going, I need to keep drinking. I can't be sober. Being sober was 10 minutes ago, and that just sucked, you know what I mean? It was awful. There's got to be a way to name the cat and get the job and do the laundry while you're a little bit buzzed, you know what I mean? There's got to be a way to do that. And that's called trying to control and enjoy our drinking, like it says in our book. And I didn't know that at the time. And, of course, I would not name the cat. I couldn't find a pen, so fuck it. I'm just going to take a 10-strip of acid, you know what I mean? And just go. And that's how it went down. One day, my mom called, like always, to tell me I was screwing up her life, and just destroying everything. And she said, I don't know what's wrong with you, but I bought you a plane ticket. Your uncle's going to come pick you up. I had an uncle in Baton Rouge, and he came and picked me up. And he got me on a plane, and I went back home. And I was in front of my big brother, like the winner, you know what I mean? And he's saying, we're drinking, you know what I mean, with all his frat guy friends. And I don't like frat guys, but they had beer, you know, and we're hanging out, and they're saying, and I just couldn't even connect with those guys at any level. These guys had jobs now. They were done with school. They were doing stuff. They were having conversations that made sense, that didn't have anything to do with being a criminal, you know what I mean? And I was like, just so uncomfortable, but still drinking and getting a little bit of hope out of that. And my brother said, look, what happened? You know, why you live with mom and dad again? And I said, well, you know, the truth is, I was selling dope to make my rent money, and the first girl I sold it to OD'd, and I didn't want to do it anymore, because, you know, it was a bad circumstance. And my brother was like, you need to go to rehab, man. And, because he'd never seen heroin before, much less tried to pay rent with it. You know what I mean? He's just that kind of guy. And he was like, rehab, you know? So I went to rehab, and I don't know why. I said, yeah, just like Miriam said, like, I don't know why. I was like, okay. And, a lot of people, I got a good friend, Eric, who says, my buddy Eric has, like, had blackouts and woken up in Fiji, you know what I mean? Like, he had some fucked up shit going out. But he says he got sober, and it wasn't a boom, it was a whimper, you know what I mean? That it finally, when it was, and that's what it was like for me. It was like, it didn't end in a big bang, or like a big dramatic thing with, like, a big talk and, like, one solitary tear going down my eye, you know what I mean? It was just like, you know what I mean? Like, okay, you know, just like, I got nothing else, man. Fuck it. Okay, I'll go, you know? And I didn't think I'd stay sober. I didn't think any of that. I just went, because what else are you going to do? I got to listen to Chad, you know? And at rehab, they told us to go to meetings, so I went to meetings. And my mom was yelling at me every day. Now I'm sober, kind of. Like, I'm doing her pills at night and drinking at night, but I'm, you know, sobriety, and I'm talking about AA and sobriety constantly to everybody who listen. And I still had a couple friends that would hang with me from high school. They're good people, and they would not drink to hang with me, you know what I mean? But as soon as I was done hanging with them, I would need to get wasted, because seeing them reminded me of the good old times in high school when I could, like that one summer where we just smoked a quarter ounce of weed every single day, you know what I mean? And went to the pool and ate pizza and played video games and drank Kool-Aid, and it was just awesome. And I wanted that again, man. I wanted to watch Friday and laugh, you know what I mean? And just be high, you know? But that wasn't happening anymore. I would get high and watch Friday, and it wasn't funny, you know what I mean? But it was still better than being sober. And so I was going to AA meetings expecting something to happen, I guess, was the truth. And nothing was happening. Except that there's another group of people to try and fit in with that I felt like I was being rejected by. You know what I mean? And that's kind of it. And then, but I did notice the people there were criminals like me, and they were liars like me, and all in their own little ways, they were like me. I identified. And then, you know, this one guy took me to another, he kind of took me under his wing from a noon meeting at an AA clubhouse called the Unity Club. He said, why don't you come tonight with me, I'll pick you up, and we'll go see my sponsor, Celebrate. And I saw this guy, Rick C., Celebrate, a really long, you know, I think it was like 16 years, but it seemed like forever. And I saw Rick talking to the guy he sponsored, the guy that picked me up, and Rick sponsored that guy. And their conversation, there was something about it that I wanted, where Tom was like, the guy that picked me up, he was kind of like reporting to the guy, you know, but I could tell they were both like drunks, you know, but he was like, so I did this, and I'm kind of mad at my wife. And Rick's like, mm-hmm. You know, he's listening. And he tells him what to do, and the guy's like, okay. And then we get in the car, and something about that, I was like, I didn't see that in the where I was going before, and it's probably going on at the clubhouse I was going to, but I just noticed it for the first time, and I saw some kind of like AA being worked, you know? And I don't know what, I just remember that. I really remember that. And then I started asking all these questions, like, you know, and my biggest worry at the time was probably, well, like when I was getting wasted all the time, my biggest concern was getting wasted. My second biggest concern was trying to not look like a jerk while I'm getting wasted, right? Like just trying to look kind of cool while I do it. And now I'm not getting wasted. So all I got is trying to look like not a jerk, you know what I mean? And I was bumping into everything in life. Like I worked at a toy store and a restaurant, and I seemed to be getting yelled at by everybody. And it would kill me, and I would just talk to the coworkers that I worked with when they weren't around, like while I was in the shower or I was in my car. I would just be talking to them constantly, just like, you know what, Matt? And I would win, and I would like, yeah, that's what I'm going to say, yeah, that's what. And then I would get to work, and I would try and like manipulate that conversation to happen because I've prepared for it and I'm ready. And then they didn't read the script, though. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't know what they were supposed to say, according to my head. And they would say something totally different and throw me for a loop, and I would just get defeated over and over again by everybody. And they didn't know we were at war, either. You know what I mean? They just didn't know. And that's kind of what was going on. And then my mom every day would wake me up and tell, you know, like, ask me something like, are you going to fail again today like you did every other fucking day, you fucking loser? You know what I mean? Like, do you know how much money we just spent on Tulane? Do you know how expensive that is? You know, like, what? Ah! And just the, you know, she's a really sweet lady, but I brought that out in her. You know what I mean? I really, really made her crazy. And so, you know, I think about, God, my mom's mean. Why can't she just let it go, you know? And I started asking him stuff like that. And then I ended up going to another group because he was speaking at it. And that night he said, you know, I'm going out to a bar tonight, so you shouldn't come because you're new. Why don't you hang out with this guy? And he didn't know that guy. But that guy was Mikey, my friend Mikey, still today. Mikey had 6 months, and he was 16 years old. And I was 19, and I had, like, a day or whatever. And he just kind of – and I was, like, eyeballing this kid. You know, I'm thinking he's a kid. I'm 19. He's 16. What are we going to do? You know what I mean? And I'm just like, ah, you know. And Mikey's looking at me like, ah, I only have 6 months, you know. And the guy grabs my hand and grabs Mikey's hand and puts them literally together in a really awkward way. And then he just, you know, and then just kind of goes off to the bar. And I had never seen that guy since. I don't know. I don't know if he drank or what, you know. But me and Mikey took me to some people's house that were all sober, that were like around my age. And a bunch of 19 and 20-year-old dudes living together, and their girlfriends were there. And these guys were funny. I mean, they were like, we watched this movie, it's an old gangster movie, and they were making fun of it the whole time. And that kind of dark, cynical way that I knew, like, when I figured sobriety would be like hanging out with those Mormons before. And there's nothing wrong with being a Mormon. I got a lot of friends that are Mormon, but those Mormons didn't tell dirty jokes. You know what I mean? And they didn't swear. And they didn't smoke cigarettes, and I felt like I could never be myself around them. But these guys were telling dirty jokes, and they were swearing, and I could tell that they had girlfriends, you know what I mean? And I was like, this is cool. And then they all started talking about soccer, and I was like, ah, I'm scared of the ball in every sport I've ever played. This isn't going to work. All right. And I just about got myself out of AA right then and there. And then this girl, Ivy, I guess saw that I was going a little nuts, and she said, let's go smoke. So we went outside and smoked. And at this point, I didn't know much about making conversation in sobriety. I knew what I knew in rehab and when I was drinking. And in rehab, you make friends by saying, what was your drug of choice, right? And Ivy was 19, but she was 4 years sober. And she hadn't heard what was your drug of choice since she was in the psych ward, right? So she thought that was just the funniest thing ever. And she said, ah, man, I don't know, the last time I got wasted, I did a bunch of WD-40. I just sprayed it up my nose. And I was like, yeah, you know, like, what a woman. You know, right now we're talking. And I'm like, this is my kind of lady. And I never shot WD-40 up my nose, but anyone who's willing to do that, to not be sober, I feel like we're cool. You know what I mean? Like, I get you, and you get me. And I identified with her. And we started making each other laugh, and then her boyfriend came outside, and I was like, bah! You know, like, man. But I was like, all right, you can't win them all. But I felt like she took the time to identify with a guy who was about to leave AA. You know what I mean? And it was just really cool, that I think, still, that she did that. Because she didn't – the guys were talking about soccer, and I was scared of – that they were going to want me to play soccer with them one day, and I was going to, like, they're going to pass me the ball, and I was going to miss it, and they're going to be like, don't pass it to that guy anymore, you know, like recess growing up or something. You know what I mean? I'm just saying, I never know what's going on in a new guy's head or a new girl's head, and how maybe just smoking a cigarette can help, or I'm quitting smoking tomorrow, hopefully, so maybe not that anymore, but, like, you know, maybe just having coffee, whatever, you know, just hanging out with each other might help change a life, you know. But so everything changed since then. She introduced me to a guy to be my sponsor. I didn't know anything about him. She just said, you should ask him to sponsor you. And he was right there, and it was uncomfortable. So I said, okay. And then he's been my sponsor for the past 12 years. And he's always been active in AA. Like, he goes to meetings. He's always trying to work a better program. He talks to his sponsor, and he talks to me about talking to his sponsor and how sometimes he's scared to call his sponsor and tell him the truth about what he did that week and what's the sponsor going to say and follow in that direction. So that's why I feel like he's a good sponsor for me, because he's constantly getting – I've seen him change over the past 12 years. And I haven't noticed much change in me, but he says that, you know, I mean, I've stayed sober, and I've seen him change so, and his sponsor, I've seen him change so much. And so he's helped me through the steps. And just like Miriam said, I mean, she said the most clear thing he can say is, you know, her sponsor helps her with the steps. I mean, what else are you going to do? And it works, you know? And that's the deal. We did a fourth and fifth step, and I identified with him. You know, we related with each other. And I felt like, you know, all the stuff that I was never, ever going to tell anyone wasn't really that big a deal. You know what I mean? And I got really active in service. And honestly, at the time, my group, not too many people had done a sixth and seventh, eighth and ninth step at the time. We were a young group. And I don't know if it's my perception or the way it really was, but it didn't seem like anyone knew how to do that stuff. So I just kind of stopped there. But we did a lot of service, you know what I mean? And I don't suggest that, but I got active in the ninth step 4 years later with the eighth and ninth. And then I started seeing, really looking into the sixth and seventh step because my eighth and ninth step wasn't going so well because you got to save up money to pay it back. And it's hard to save up money if you can't keep a job. And it's hard to keep a job if you drink coffee all night and hang out with your friends because you don't feel good about yourself. You know what I mean? So I started looking at character defects and you know, maybe I got to not drink coffee at the meeting and go to bed early so I can wake up early so I can keep the job. And then maybe I got to not eat out every meal so I can save up the money. And those are day-to-day decisions that have to do with the sixth step and asking God for help that helped me change just enough to put together just enough money to pay off all the stuff in my credit report. You know what I mean? And that took some time for me. But I know lots of people in the first year that knock all that stuff out. It wasn't my case, you know. But it's gotten really sweet, you know what I mean? I've gotten to be... The group I was in was real active in young people's conferences, so I did that for a while. And I got to host two Icky Paws, and those are fun. And I got to move down to Florida. The truth behind it, I mean, like, I was going to move down here, and I guess what I tell grown-ups or, like, job interviews is I moved to Florida to go to college, you know what I mean? But really, my girlfriend dumped me in AA, and I didn't want to look at her at the meetings anymore because it was uncomfortable. And a friend of mine moved to Florida, so I was like, me too, you know what I mean? And I ended up here, and I was a big hot mess at 2.5 years sober. And Bill knew me then, and I tried to bum gas money off Bill, like, the first time I met him, I think. And he, like, looked at me, he's like, are you fucking kidding me? You know what I mean? And that helped me a lot, because that night I couldn't sleep, and I was like, Bill hates me, you know what I mean? And since then, I don't think I've ever bummed gas money off of anybody, you know? But that was a good time for me, because I had to look at, I was in AA up until that point, really active in service, doing making lots of coffee. I was starting meetings, you know what I mean? Bidding for conferences, calling my sponsor every day, telling him what's going on. But I couldn't hold a job, and I was bumming lunch money off. Every time I'd go out to eat, I'd be hitting somebody up or bumming cigarettes off of somebody. And I wasn't being self-supporting. And when I got to Florida, it was just me and my buddy and his buddy. And there's only three people to buy me lunch, you know what I mean? So that's a big problem. And you know, it just all fell apart really quick. And all of a sudden, I'm couch surfing in AA. And you know, and I prayed a lot. And up until that point, I would think, well, if I do AA, everything will work out. And that's true to some extent, but you have to, like, go to bed early and wake up on time and keep a job. I mean, you got to work, you know what I mean, to pay the bills. And can't just go to the noon, you know what I mean? At least in my case, going to the noon wasn't the right thing to do when I was unemployed. It was looking for a job all day was, you know, and I had to learn that the hard way. But long story short, I found a couch on the side of the road. I found a new guy who didn't have a couch, so I gave him the couch, and then I said, can I sleep on it? And he said, yeah. And then I slept on the couch for 2 weeks. We arranged a deal. I would pay him $5 a day for rent until I found a place. On the last day, I had done a paint job for somebody at their house in AA, and I had a little bit of money, and I paid back everyone I owed, and I had a quarter left. It was a whole quarter. And I was walking back to the couch, and this is on a college campus at USF, and this really pretty girl was kicking a Coke machine because they ate her last nickel, and she needed a nickel to get a Coke, and I gave her my quarter, and we moved in with each other, and then she talked me into getting student loans, so we get student loans, and then I end up going to school, and we're, like, together for the next 2 years, and she gets a job at a methadone clinic, and Dave was her client there, and then Dave pretty much got everyone else sober, you know what I mean? That's kind of how it worked. It seemed like it at the time, because they were, like, his brother got sober, and then his friend from Nordstrom got sober, you know what I mean? And then, like, all these other people. And right around the same time, we met Ryan, you know what I mean? And Ryan moved in with my buddy Jaime, And they started, like, people just around us in this little tiny group here, and Bill was coming, and Todd, and it went from, like five people, you know, just kind of meeting up every Thursday but hanging out afterwards, to, like, growing a little bit more and a little bit more. And there seemed like there was always new people around, you know what I mean? And I got to watch, you know, Ryan and Dave change in front of me, you know what I mean? And it was amazing, and I felt like I was the biggest mess ever. And I felt like, honestly, at the time, it's funny looking back, because I felt like I was this big fraud. Like, I'm going to college just so I can have a place to live, really. But in the end of it, I got a college degree, you know what I mean? And I look back at that sometimes now, and I think, maybe I should just be grateful for where I'm at now, you know what I mean? Like, at the time, I was having a really good time, and I have all these fun, sober memories, but I think I remember being in so much fear at the time, like, of all just the daily troubles and this and that. But the memories are still sweet. It's kind of funny how that works. But I moved back to D.C., got a job, mended the relationship with my parents to a point where I haven't yelled, and they haven't yelled ever. I mean, since in so many years, it seems crazy that ever even happened, you know? We're buddies now. And I'm going up this weekend to take care of my mom. She fell and broke her femur, and now she got a new hip. So I'm going to hang out with her. And it's awful, awful what happened. But I guess the only good news of that is she would appreciate me being around and being helpful. You know what I mean? And she got a Wii, like a Nintendo Wii, so I'm going to hook that up for her and be useful. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what I'm into these days. My sponsor, that's what he talks to me about, is, well, how were you useful? Were you useful at work? Were you a worker among workers? Paying your bills on time? Are you useful in your AA meeting? You know what I mean? Did you just go to the meeting and meet up with some friends and chit-chat and try and look good or in showboat? Or did you actually stick your hand out to any new people and figure out, you know, who you could introduce them to improve their life, you know? And that's been my job. Back in D.C., that was kind of my service position in my home group that my sponsor gave me. Is I don't want you to talk to any of your friends this entire time. You show up an hour before and stay half an hour late, and I just want you to meet new people and figure out where they live, do they have a car, you know, how long they've been sober, and who would best meet up with them. And I had the benefit of a group like this size, where you kind of know someone who lives in every area, and you know who drives, and you know who's got what work schedule, and it's a pretty cool, it's a pretty powerful thing, and you can be pretty useful in that way, just connect people to each other. And that's been, I don't know, I feel like that's my job here in AA now, you know what I mean, just to show up one more day, just be useful again, and it's always an adventure, you know what I mean, always is. So that's all I got, but thanks a lot for letting me share.
I'm Kaylin, I'm an alcoholic, and this is Dr. Bob's last message. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this, with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength has not returned as I would like, so my remarks of necessity will be very brief. But there are two or three things that have flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of our program. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is, and we understand what service is, so let's bear those two things in mind. Let's also remember to guard the erring member, the tongue, and if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous little kind and thoughtful acts on our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency so that we're not willing to extend or attempt to that help which has been so beneficial to us. To our less fortunate brothers, thank you very much.